A Fee Classic. Ezekiel's Job by Ridgway K. Foley, Jr. Mr. Foley, a partner in Schwabe, Williamson, and Wyatt, practices law in Portland, Oregon. Basic distinctions often prove elusive. Whether by virtue of inattention, human resistance, lack of comprehension, or some indefinable perversity of life, we human beings often fail to grasp and act upon the most central differences both of concept and deed. As a result, all manner of disappointing and disturbing events take place, just as one misstep at the outset of a journey can foreordain an unexpected destination. Consider one such essential distinction. Personal belief and action, premised upon a set moral code, versus the coercive imposition of one's moral strictures upon another, unwilling human being. The dissimilarity is fundamental and not particularly obscure. Yet, the blurring and commingling of these two very different precepts and their attendant activities have vexed men and women across time. The prophet Ezekiel provides insights into this common and perplexing situation. Of course, it is not with it to relate modern problems to some old fellow who lived long ago and far away. In the skeptical and intolerant climate of today, so lacking in the civility of open thought, it just does not meet the modern dictates of intellectual exclusivity to refer to the Bible, to Christianity, or to any traditional religion, particularly one with established attitudes of right and wrong. Yet the book of Ezekiel lays a firm foundation from which all of us, no matter our religious persuasion, may investigate the differences between proper belief and proper respect for the beliefs of others. After all, the essence of the human condition remains unchanged despite the passage of centuries. Recall the backdrop of history. The Jewish people received the gift of insight into the very marrow of the individual, the ability to choose, to evaluate, and to select among alternatives, and in so doing, to affect not only the actor's destiny, but also the course of a lineal world history. Recall the passage in the book of Deuteronomy. I have set before thee this day life and good, and death and evil. I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore choose life, that both thou and thy seed shall live. These ancient men and women displayed the same features and failings as we do. At times they made venal, undesirable, and unwise choices, and as a result suffered the inexorable consequences which flowed from their conduct. As a nation, ancient Israel waxed and waned. Things worked out well when the people adhered to the Ten Commandments, and bad times followed their evil exploits. God endowed men with freedom, even the freedom to forsake Him and to choose wrongly, for freedom necessarily entails the freedom to fail. Although the ineluctable law of cause and consequence foretold unpleasant sequels from inappropriate acts, the Jews of old seemed hell-bent on the eternal folly of trying to beat the house. Now and then, when the Hebrew nation deviated sufficiently from the proper standard of behavior, God sent a prophet, a man assigned to remind his flock of the rules of the game and to warn them of the inevitable lunacy of trying to avoid responsibility for their wickedness. Sometimes the body politic listened. More often, the people ignored, joshed, or abused the prophet. Ezekiel was one of the major prophets, a chap God called forth 26 centuries ago during one of those troubled times for Israel. Prophets were role players. They were given a part to play without a thought of the consequences. They spoke to largely hostile audiences. they faced uncomfortable and sometimes dangerous situations. They forsook popularity, credibility, status, and wealth. In return, they knew that somewhere, somehow, a dutiful remnant would hear and heed the words they uttered as God's intermediary. Ezekiel fit right into this tapestry of history and role of prophet. God instructed him, and he in turn carried the message to those of the multitude who chose to listen. And it is that critical message recorded in Ezekiel, chapter 33, verses 1 to 11, which edifies us specifically as to the dichotomy between personal commitment and coerced orthodoxy. Those verses in chapter 33 of Ezekiel impart threefold tidings. First, God tells his people, "I have sent thee a watchman." And he outlines the obligations of the watchman. Second, he advises the remnant of the duties laid upon those who hear his watchman. Third, and most saliently for our present purpose, he answers the ageless inquiry of the listeners. How should we then live? How should we then live? Distinguish between the relativism of a humanistic "man is the measure of all things" precept and an understanding that imperfect individuals will profess different beliefs. It is one thing to ascertain for oneself how the moral life is to be lived. It is quite another matter to impose that particular view upon an unwilling neighbor. The Christian may think it great folly for each man to live according to his internal moral code, oblivious to God's law, or each individual's innate sense of truth and justice. Does this profession of faith necessarily or properly vest in the practicing Christian the right to compel all others to accept his creed? Or rather, doesn't the modern theocrat, be he religious, atheistic, or agnostic, confuse subjective value with moral absolutes? Thus, the remnant, through Ezekiel, asked God, "How should we then live?" and received a simple and direct mandate. "As I live, saith the Lord." Yet, simple declarations may cloak deeper lessons. Surely, reflective men and women in the 6th century before Christ, as now, wondered how the Lord did live. And for the Jew of 2,600 years ago, as for the Christian in the late 20th century, the answer appears in the recorded reports of eyewitnesses to history. God often provided sound answers to this secondary inquiry, "How does the Lord live?" for Old Testament followers. For example, in the entire passage from Deuteronomy abstracted heretofore, God directed his people to follow his statutes and laws, a message often repeated but seldom heeded. He condensed his rules of conduct in the Ten Commandments, a precise summary not dissimilar from the essential teachings of most of the world's great religions, and not wholly unlike the alleged inbred innate moral sense so popularly presupposed in current lore to reside in all individuals. Somehow, the content of these simple yet exact rules of order either escaped most folks or suffered the serious amelioration of convenience. Hebraic law became burdensomely formal and uselessly coercive, smothering the essence in arid dust. People became baffled. How did God live? Was it as some neighbor declared? Or according to the local prophet, general, or rabbi? Couldn't these restrictive commandments be modified just a bit to fit a particular case which coincidentally happened to be of personal interest to the inquirer? Didn't modern times mandate more modern and less archaic solutions? And so, the waxing and waning of the Old Testament travails continued unabated long after Ezekiel departed. For the Christian, a remarkable and unprecedented event occurred 2,000 years ago. God answered the second inquiry, "How does the Lord live?" in a unique and direct way. God became incarnate, sending his Son in the form of a man to live among witnesses, to encounter and suffer the range of human events and emotions, and incidentally, to show us just how the Lord does live. In the examination of Jesus' life, set against the backdrop of the Old Testament law, we see not only how the Lord lives, but also the stark distinction between principled personal belief and the mandate to respect the beliefs, no matter how dissimilar or possibly erroneous, of others. Simply put, Jesus lived a life of pristine purity. He adhered to the essence of the Ten Commandments and eschewed sin and evil. He built no monuments to his reign. He assembled no mighty army to strike down the soldiers of Satan. He accepted no patronage. He granted no special favors. He left no estate of substance. In short, Jesus lived quite unlike any human being, ruler or ruled, in all of human history. Did Jesus ever force anyone to believe, to chant his praise, to recite his creed, to follow him? Did he ever box the ears of an unreceptive and hooting audience and charge them to be Christians and do exactly as I say and do, or I'll whomp you? Did he ever ostracize or humiliate those who declined his offers? There is absolutely no evidence of such behavior. Layers of lessons abound in the Lord's answer to Ezekiel's question, and each layer offers guidance for believer and non-believer alike. First, Ezekiel and his counterparts must adhere to principle in a sea of challenge, doubt, and seduction. Absolutes in the form of correct choices and proper principles do exist. Consequences flow from all choices, results that must be endured, events that beget future choices. The principled individual is charged to live scrupulously, to make the right choice at each and every opportunity, be he Christian or Jew, atheist or agnostic. The distinction exists in the standard. When the moral individual refuses to soften this quest for perfection, he is often met with derision, enticement, or compulsion. In this regard, scant differences separate the doctrinaire libertarian and the overzealous Christian. There appears a natural human tendency to challenge the beliefs of others, first through shunning and scorn, last by force and fraud. Those most inflexible in principle seem to suffer the greatest assaults, possibly because the traducers implicitly recognize the propriety of the upright and seek to wrench them down to their level. Disorderly man occupies an orderly sphere and setting. Gifted with the power to choose, flawed mankind necessarily makes poor choices on occasion, for freedom encompasses the power and the right to be wrong. The Christian is called only to be a faithful steward, not a perfect one. Perfection is our goal. It is not within our grasp. Intolerance of human failings, of self or others, often eclipses the quest for betterment. This inherent intolerance leads directly to the second layer of understanding and the dichotomy between principle and force. Second, then, Jesus' answer to Ezekiel's inquiry aptly illustrates the difference between holding and practicing a belief and demanding adherence by others to that ideal. While men are flawed, God is not. Yet Jesus did not command obedience to his banner, although he knew it to be true, nor should men. Indeed, Since men, unlike God, do not inevitably know that they hold proper principles and exhibit correct behavior, they ought not compel others to accept and adopt a possibly flawed precept. Ample manifestations of the impermissible blurring of principle and command appear upon reflection. The religious zealot who seizes the machinery of government establishes a state religion de facto or de jure, enacts blue laws, and orders compulsory chapel. The arid libertarian who, intolerant of any suggestion that others might reach similar results from dissimilar bases, mocks his Christian counterpart out of the discussion. The well-meaning sophisticate, concerned about the homeless, the young, the irascible, or the disabled, who induces the county commission to use tax revenues to pay for shelters and rehabilitation centers. The illiberal liberal, who concocts false testimony concerning and selectively applies state legal sanctions against disliked religious persons or groups who hear a different voice and dare to speak out. Sadly, the list appears endless. For religious and agnostic alike, the concept of witness has all too often transmuted proper belief and the quest for moral excellence into an evil charade, replete with clever rationalizations, as each individual seeks to impose his agenda upon all others, to limit the discussion to prescribed topics, and to foreordain all solutions, hence circumscribing human action with his own finite boundaries in the name of his truth. Third, Ezekiel reveals the role assigned to the committed. They are called to be watchmen. Watchmen perform specific tasks. They search out the truth, live out the truth, and speak out the truth in order that others may hear and assimilate. No one expects a watchman to battle those about him. Watchmen cry out. They sound the bell. They raise the alarm. But Ezekiel does not suggest that the watchman's obligations include compelling anyone to believe, to profess, or to act in any discreet manner. Instead, God's watchmen provide knowledge and opportunity, a palpable form of due process, to any and all who choose to consider the message. The watchman directive applies to the non-religious believer by a parity of reasoning. Leonard E. Reed devoted many of his adult years to the study and explication of the appropriate methodology of freedom. He repeatedly reminded his readers and listeners that one who truly espouses the freedom philosophy could not coerce others to adopt those premises, since to attempt to do so would constitute the most startling contradiction in terms. He admonished us that the end pre-exists in the means. The bloom pre-exists in the rose. If we improve our own self and live according to right precepts, others will observe and be drawn to the proper path by the flame of attraction. Leonard Reed's instruction does not differ in essence from God's admonition to Ezekiel and echoed in Matthew Chapter 16, verse 5, to let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. In this fashion, the Ezekiel passage makes it manifest that committed individuals are duty-bound to honor their commitment, but they are not to coerce others to follow their opinions or mimic their precepts. They should seek the truth, follow the right, improve the self, and never stray from fundamental principle. In the timeless truth of the redoubtable F.A. Harper, a principle can be broken, but it cannot be bent. Concomitantly, committed men and women should attract others by the light of their words and the propriety of their deeds, never by the exercise of compulsion, aggression, fraud, manipulation, or malevolence, with or without the sanction of the state. Further, Ezekiel offers us a fourth lesson. Those who hear the watchman must heed his warning or suffer the consequences. Remember, one need not accept or act favorably upon a warning. But God makes it clear that the listener disregards the sound of the tocsin at his own peril. Once more, this passage accords with the fundamentals of freedom. Force and freedom are inimical. Freedom includes the freedom to fail, to make choices that seem wrong to legions of observers, to act meanly or intolerantly or foolishly, to go against the crowd. The essence of man resides in his power to make meaningful choices that will affect not only his life, but also the lives of others here and hereafter. Deprivation of this power of creative choice, for whatever reason, not only limits that man's array of selections, but also diminishes him as a person. To enslave is much too light and lax a verb to describe such oppression, for the person restricted is thereby lessened as a human being, stunted in his potential, and cut down in his moral growth. God's watchman must speak out fearlessly, and his listeners must act accordingly, or both will suffer inevitable consequences of their respective breaches of duty. But nowhere does the message provide that disagreeing men should either thwart the warning or forestall the reaction by destructive means. Just so, the observant non-believer may deny the existence of the law of gravity. But when he leaps from an airplane without a parachute, he pays the price for his sincere, if incorrect, intellectual position. What limits, then, restrain human action? The rules and order of the universe and the civil sanctions against aggression. The nature of man and the consequential constraints of the world permit growth but preclude perfection. The civil or positive law, no less than the essential biblical code, ought to deter and punish the employment of fraud and the initiation of aggression. After all, if Ezekiel demonstrates that proper belief does not include the coercive imposition of that belief upon an unwilling other, the lesson must also implicitly disparage the use of force for lesser purposes as well. Most compulsion develops seemingly as a quest for good and as an affray against evil. Those who seek to do good by coercive means accomplish great evil by depriving their subjects of their primary human trait. These dictators, great and small, live as men do, not as God. Commitment to Christianity and to the free society are one and the same. The sole difference of note lies in the choices made by freely choosing individuals once all recognize the fundamental difference between commitment to principle and the use of compulsion to impose that principle upon others. End of Ezekiel's Job by Ridgway K. Foley, Jr. We hope you have enjoyed this September 1990 edition of the Freeman on Tape. For information, write to the Foundation for Economic Education, 30 South Broadway, Irvington on Hudson, New York, 10533, or call area code 914-591-7230. It is the lone worker who makes the first advance in a subject. The details may be worked out by a team, but the prime idea is due to the enterprise, thought, and perception of an individual. Sir Alexander Fleming. Welcome to the September 1990 edition of The Freeman on Tape. The Freeman on Tape is published by the Foundation for Economic Education, 30 South Broadway, Irvington-on-Hudson, New York, 10533. The September 1990 edition of The Freeman on Tape contains on side one, The Census, Eyes of the Intrusive State, by Eric A. Johnson. What's Happened to Community Spirit? By James L. Payne. Mandated Airline Safety Seats Won't Increase Travel Safety? By John Simmons. And Airbags, More Government Hot Air? By Anthony Young. And on side two, a fee classic, Ezekiel's Job? By Ridgway K. Foley, Jr. The Census, Eyes of the Intrusive State, by Eric A. Johnson. Eric A. Johnson, a writer and publishing consultant in Southern California, is the former managing editor of The New American magazine. In 1790, David Howe of Hancock County, Maine, accepted the responsibility for counting the number of people in an area of his state loosely defined by such natural boundaries as foothills, forests, and streams. When he had finished, he posted in several public places his list of the whole number of persons counted, 9,549, naming only heads of households, and offering as his only statistical analysis the fact that he had included in the enumeration inhabitants of some isles, not part of named towns. In a letter to the federal government which accompanied his simple report, Howe opined that he had adequately discharged his duties merely by doing the best possible job under the circumstances. President Washington would have been quite satisfied with Howe's work on that first federal census, inasmuch as his own expectations about its scope and accuracy were quite low. The Bicentennial Census of 1990, on the other hand, is being administered by bureaucrats who have much higher expectations for its results. By amassing data on farms, factories, commerce, communities, institutions and individuals, the United States government can better manage the myriad programs which seek to fund and administer the needs of the nation and its people. This, at least, was the message of the massive national advertising campaign of early 1990, which exhorted Americans to fill out census questionnaires with between 13 and 58 more questions than are necessary for a straightforward enumeration. In 1790, David Howe simply went about counting people, asking only for the names of heads of households and the number of people in them. But in 1990, in addition to requesting basic name and address information, Bureau of the Census interrogatories delved into Americans' mortgages, pregnancies, language proficiency, work habits, intimate relationships, and indoor plumbing, empowered by a federal law that makes noncompliance punishable by a fine of up to $500. How did the simple census of 1790 evolve into the invasive census of today? How did the elementary enumeration of Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3 of the United States Constitution become the compulsory categorization of today? Despite its big government bias, Anne Herbert Scott's Census USA, Fact-Finding for the American People, 1790 to 1970, New York, The Seabury Press, 1968, is perhaps the best book on the history of the U.S. Census. Scott, who worked as an enumerator in the Agricultural Census of 1964, acknowledges in her book that the Bureau of the Census provided working headquarters and enthusiastic assistance while she was writing Census USA in the late 1960s. At the Constitutional Convention, Scott explains correctly, it was determined after much debate that a single headcount for the purposes of apportioning representatives and direct taxes made the most sense. The states would not be tempted to arrive at a fatter figure for the former and a leaner one for the latter. It was the practical problem of balancing power, rather than a scientific interest in obtaining statistics on the people, that gave birth to the census, Scott writes. It wasn't long, however, before politicians and bureaucrats began to expand the meaning and the manner of the decennial census to meet the growing needs of a growing government. Throughout the early 1800s, the census increased in scope and complexity. In addition to including information on manufacturing, agriculture, and foreign trade, by the 1840s, the census sought to count and categorize the convicts, the deaf and dumb, and the insane and idiots in American society. Legislation passed in 1879 to 1880 created a census office in the Department of the Interior and took census responsibilities away from the U.S. Marshals. Soon thereafter, 150 census supervisor positions were added to the burgeoning federal bureaucracy and filled by civil servants and political appointees. These supervisors reported to a superintendent appointed by the president, which serves to explain why the census process in the last two decades of the 1800s fell victim to the effects of bureaucratic cronyism and party politics. In 1902, the Bureau of the Census received its present name and permanent status in the federal bureaucracy. By the end of the 19th century, about the time that our government began to flex its muscles in the formerly private realms of commerce and industry, the purpose of the census was clearly not enumeration, but the collection and analysis of information for central planning. By the first decade of the 20th century, when our once isolationist nation began to be enamored of its new military strength and the trappings of empire, the once public listings of persons counted had been replaced by secret reports, providing much more than population information to a federal government interested in more than simple statistics. During the early decades of the 20th century, the Bureau of the Census managed to stake out its bureaucratic turf, justify increased budget allocations, and consolidate power through political alliances. When Franklin Roosevelt brought his interventionist philosophy to Washington in 1932, the Bureau of the Census was ready to provide grist for the mills of the New Deal. In her chronicle of the Bureau's New Deal years, Scott reports with evident approval the fact that leading populists, progressives, and socialists of the era were pleased with FDR's attempts to hotwire the engine of capitalism with plans based on scientific studies, many of which, of course, were based on census data. From the end of Roosevelt's reign until Scott wrote her book in the late 1960s, each new administration had the Bureau of the Census concentrate on three main tasks: modernizing its information systems, producing more numerous and more sophisticated abstracts of data, and integrating requests for updated information into censuses and surveys. By the end of the 1960s, social and economic engineers had already convinced the majority of Americans that big government was here to stay. After 2 centuries and 21 censuses, we've arrived at the clear dividing line between the government's desire, not its right, to know about us, and our right, if we so desire, to maintain our privacy. A thin line underscoring the word compulsion. There is opposition to the compulsory census from all points on America's political spectrum, but there is not yet sufficient support in Congress for remedial legislation. In 1976, the House of Representatives voted 248 to 140 to abolish all civil and criminal penalties for refusal to answer census questions, but the bill died in the Senate. Two fundamental lessons in liberty emerge from the study of the mutant census. One, that a collectivist state, whether democratic or totalitarian, cannot survive without intimate information about its people with which to design and administer its central plans, and two, that the accumulation of such information will inevitably lead a free society into collectivism, as politicians, both altruistic and Machiavellian, justify regulation, intervention, and social programming for the amelioration of innumerable slights, plights, and injustices, real or imagined. Over the last 200 years, the U.S. government has accumulated more and more information on the American people and their activities, while politicians and special interest groups have used the data to perform social surgeries. But the more they operated on society, the more they wanted to know about the patient. Thus began the vicious cycle: more data leading to more programs producing more data, which lead to still more programs producing more data, and on and on. With questionable legislation but unquestioned police power behind it, the Bureau of the Census continues to pry into people's lives and add to the federal government's store of knowledge about American citizens. But considering the mounting congressional opposition to the compulsory census and Americans' increasing awareness of governmental excesses, census bureaucrats might encounter growing resistance as they put the finishing touches on the 1990 study. In fact, they should count on it. What's Happened to Community Spirit? By James L. Payne. James L. Payne has taught political science at Yale, Wesleyan, Johns Hopkins, and Texas A&M. He is working on a book on negative effects of tax systems, hosting the Federal Banquet, The Overhead Cost of Taxation. Are people as considerate as they used to be? Drive through any large city, and you don't even have to get out of your car to know the answer. You can see the vandalism that has destroyed property, the graffiti that insults the passerby, the litter and trash thoughtlessly thrown, the steel grillwork to check the press of crime. The occasional jogger runs with an attack dog. What we see in the streets is reflected at other levels of society. Professions that used to be characterized by an ethic of service and self-sacrifice, such as nursing and teaching, are now known for strikes, where members abandon their responsibilities for personal gain. Bankers and brokers overlook their fiduciary duties to make personal killings. Even our top public servants, the congressmen, are a national scandal, grasping for higher incomes and benefits at the expense of the community. Today, everybody seems to be reading Self magazine. What can be done about all this selfishness? How can we move toward a society of helpful, caring individuals? Several generations ago, a lot of reform-minded people thought they had the solution. It was government. Government was supposed to amplify our community-oriented impulses in helpful, compassionate programs. Government was supposed to check our self-centered disregard for others and make us behave nicely. Obviously, something is fundamentally wrong with this theory. Over the past century, government helping and correcting programs have multiplied many times over, yet instead of a society of considerate, sensitive individuals, we have an alarming jungle. What happened? The answer is that reformers didn't understand government. They overlooked the fact that government is a coercive institution, that it works by using physical force to push people around. Guns, billy clubs, handcuffs, and jails. Once you realize that, you begin to see why government action undermines community spirit. Forcing people to do things, even nice things, does not make them nice. It makes them resentful and self-centered. Suppose your neighbor has a barking dog that is bothering you. If you take a gun and threaten to kill him and his dog, he will probably do something to end the barking. But is he going to feel helpful toward you in the future? If your battery is dead some freezing night, is he going to get out of bed to give you a jump start? The same principle applies when society uses force. Federal, state, and local governments are now making wide use of coercion to produce desired behavior in a myriad of activities. Force is being used to dictate hiring and firing decisions. Force is being used to prevent all but officially approved individuals from operating schools, restaurants, bus lines, clinics, beauty salons, and scores of other enterprises. Force is being used, through the government's legal liability system, to enable individuals to pursue real and imagined grievances against businesses, professionals, and neighbors. Each instance in which force or the threat of force makes someone do what he didn't want to do adds to the cynicism. The individual is increasingly persuaded that he lives in a hostile world and must protect himself. And so he indoctrinates his children, his friends, and acquaintances. You've got to watch out for number one. Talk about helpfulness and self-sacrifice is for saps. The message spreads even to congressmen. How to reverse the process? The answer is simple, but many will have to swallow hard to accept it. Recognize what government is. Make explicit the fact that government involves the use of physical force. When, for example, Congress takes up the issue of access for the handicapped, don't say, "We should use government to help the handicapped." Say what you mean. We should use coercion to help the handicapped. Once we recognize what government really is, it will be easy to notice how we undermine civility by resorting to it. Mandated airline safety seats won't increase travel safety. By John Semmons. Mr. Semmons is an economist for the Laissez-Faire Institute in Tempe, Arizona. Last year, three unrestrained children were killed in two separate airline crashes. Speculating that these children might have survived had they been belted into child safety seats, the National Transportation Safety Board has proposed that the federal government require such seats for infants and toddlers flying on commercial airlines. Proponents of the regulation point out that adult passengers are provided with seat belts. Why shouldn't small children be equally protected? Should parents be allowed to save money by risking their children's lives? Shouldn't the government make them behave more responsibly? This all sounds very plausible. Who can be against safety? Yet, like so many other paternalistic schemes, the overlooked cost factor will undermine even the best intentions. Safety regulation advocates frequently assert that we should be willing to pay whatever it takes to assure safety, especially when children are involved. The reality, though, is that our means are limited. We can't buy all the safety imaginable. Consumers must fit travel safety into a family budget, along with food, clothing, medical care, and shelter. If parents with small children are required to buy an additional airline ticket to cover the safety seat, rather than carry these children on their laps, three responses are possible. One possibility is that parents will, in fact, sacrifice some other expenditure in order to pay for the child's seat. However, child safety seats are currently available, and many parents don't buy them. Also, just as restaurants can refuse service to people without shoes or shirts, airlines could refuse to carry a child without his being belted into a safety seat. That most parents and airlines don't voluntarily incur this expense indicates that there is consumer resistance to buying an additional ticket for a small child. We shouldn't assume that such choices are inherently bad. The chance of an accident for any given airline departure is 1 in 300,000. The chance that a safety seat would make a difference is even less. Airline travel is safe and has been getting safer over the years. It is hardly irrational or irresponsible for a family to balk at paying an extra amount, possibly hundreds of dollars, for the remote chance that it will buy more safety. Sacrificing some other expenditure to pay for the child's extra ticket isn't the only option available to parents. They might decide to make the trip by alternate means. A most likely choice will be the family car. However, statistics show that intercity automobile travel is much more dangerous than commercial air travel. The fatality rate for commercial airlines is about 3 deaths per 10 billion passenger miles. The fatality rate for auto transportation is about 220 deaths per 10 billion vehicle miles. In short, a family's chances of being killed on a trip are 70 times higher in the family car than on an airline. If the additional cost of the child safety seat leads to more automobile travel, not only would the regulation induce a family to select a less desired transportation option, it would also increase their risk. Even if only 2% of the parents with children small enough to be affected by the proposed regulation opt for auto transportation, the regulation will have the net result of increasing total travel fatalities. The few lives saved by the rule will be more than offset by the dozens or even hundreds of lives lost in highway accidents. The surge in air travel following the deregulation-inspired price cuts suggests that the decision to fly is highly sensitive to the cost. Since the families affected by a mandatory child safety seat rule would typically see their air transportation cost rise by 25 to 50%, the shift to auto is likely to be much greater than 2%. A final option for a family facing the higher cost of air travel under the new regulation would be to not make the trip at all. Once again, people would be forced to accept a less desired alternative. But while staying at home won't expose them to the hazards of air or highway travel, neither will it guarantee perfect safety. Whatever activity is substituted for the foregone travel will have its own hazards. For example, in the past year, more toddlers died in backyard swimming pool accidents in Phoenix than died due to the lack of child safety seats on airlines in the entire nation. All this is not to say that using an airline safety seat is a bad idea. People can be informed of the benefits and costs and encouraged to choose wisely. But they should be allowed to choose for themselves. The world is complex. The needs and wants of people are diverse. Attempting to force everyone into the same choice, as the proposed child safety seat rule would do, diminishes individual freedom and, as we have seen, enlarges hidden risks. The notion that there is an inevitable trade-off between freedom and safety is false. Regulatory suppression of free choice can very likely decrease safety. Rather than using governmental power to coerce people into less satisfying and sometimes more dangerous alternatives, why not leave them free to choose for themselves? Airbags, More Government Hot Air, by Anthony Young. Mr. Young, a regular contributor to Automobile Quarterly, has written extensively on the automotive industry. The automobile today is as much a product of government regulation as of corporate design and innovation. For decades, automobile manufacturers designed and built cars without government intrusion. That ended in the 1960s. The automobile suddenly became the focus of environmental activists and safety advocates. The number of regulations affecting cars in the late 60s amounted to only a trickle at first, but quickly reached storm surge proportions in the 1970s. Manufacturers were forced to redirect much of their design and engineering manpower to the new wave of regulations. New words and phrases entered the automotive lexicon. Emissions, impact-absorbing bumpers, crash-worthiness, rollover standards, passive restraints. The last of these, passive restraints, proved the most abhorrent to the manufacturers, and the companies worked tirelessly to prevent such legislation from being passed. The car makers argued that such devices were complex, very costly, and embraced unproven technology. Some cautioned that in certain circumstances, airbags, as they came to be known, might even be dangerous.
There was also the fear of product liability lawsuits in the rare instances where the airbags failed to inflate. The insurance industry lobbied for implementation of passive restraints, stating airbags would save lives and reduce injuries. Airbags would also save the insurance companies millions of dollars in claims. The debate raged for years. Seatbelt interlocks were tried in the 1970s, forcing drivers to buckle up before their cars would start. But owners found ways of getting around this, and the idea was scrapped. In fact, Americans never have been great believers in the use of seatbelts. Despite the life-saving and injury-preventing qualities of lap and shoulder belts, roughly half of all drivers eschew them, even with mandatory seatbelt laws in most states. The airbag, and in some instances automatic seatbelts that wrap around the driver when the car door is closed, circumvent the recalcitrant nature of the American driving public. The government says, in effect, since you refuse to exercise good common sense by wearing a seatbelt, the U.S. government has decided to protect you from yourself. And you must pay for it. For those who refuse to buckle up, there are airbags. And drivers equipped with airbags will be the first to extol the virtues of the device after surviving a head-on collision. Unfortunately, the other 50% of drivers who wear lap and shoulder belts are now forced to pay for a redundant and costly passive restraint, starting with the 1990 model year. However, airbags are not yet required in every vehicle the manufacturer makes. Consequently, some new car buyers, having worn lap and shoulder belts for years, are balking at new airbag-equipped cars and are selectively shopping for new vehicles without airbags. The airbag is yet another example of government trying to improve the automobile for society. As is so often the case, once government gets involved in the regulation of a product, light is never seen at the end of the tunnel. There is never a stated final goal. There is only an ongoing effort of improvement. Government regulation of the automobile has taken on a life of its own, the most notable result being a much more expensive product. End of side one. Please forward the tape to the end and turn the cassette over.